Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is James Sturtevant, who is a social studies teacher from Ohio in the USA. He's recently published a book aimed at helping teachers bond with students entitled You Gotta Connect. And this is going to be the main topic of the discussion today. Hello, James. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Good afternoon, Barry.
Okay, well, could you begin, James, by telling us maybe a bit about yourself and what prompted you to write the book?
Sure. I teach social studies in a high school in Central Ohio. For those of you that are familiar with North American geography, if you think of the Great Lakes, I'm about 100 miles south of Lake Erie, which is the least impressive Great Lake, by the way. And I've been teaching for 30 years, which is hard to fathom. American high schools, we have students roughly between 14 and 18 years old.
Yeah.
I teach in the school of about 1,100 kids. I teach in a small community outside of the city. The city is called Columbus, which it's a fair-sized city. It has about 1.5 million.
Yeah.
But I live in a pretty small town just outside the city limits,
yeah.
And my town is largely white, socially and politically conservative, and believe it or not, my kids are remarkably open-minded. Now, as far as why I wrote the book, one thing that we do here in the USA, and I'm sure many countries around the world do it the same, is before someone becomes a teacher, they have to go through an apprenticeship, where they have to go out with an experienced teacher and work with them for a while and prove that they can do the job. And I've had a number of student teachers over the years, and I had this guy about 5 years back, and he was doing a good job. So his professor came to watch him teach, and he had a good class. And after class, the professor pulled me aside, and Barry, this is going to sound terribly self-promotional, and I apologize for this, but this is the story about how the book came about.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And she says, you know, I'm in classes all the time, and I have to tell you, the atmosphere in your class is spectacular. She goes, your students are animated, but at the same time, they're very relaxed and happy. Mm-hmm. How in the world did you create this? Now, I pride myself on somebody who's able to string together coherent words to form a sentence on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I just sputtered for the next 30 seconds. I had no rational response to that rather logical question. And so that haunted me. And so I had to do some classwork to maintain my teaching certification.
Yeah.
I went to Otterbein University, where the student teacher was from, and I said, hey, your professor asked me a question I couldn't answer. How about if we do an independent study this summer and we'll just research this topic on how to connect with students, how to build a really good class atmosphere?
Yeah.
And so for the summer, this lady by the name of Diane Ross is a professor there. We just talked and bannered and read. At the end of the summer, she said, this is really good. You should turn it into a publisher. And that's exactly how it happened.
That sounds really interesting, how that whole thing evolved.
And I can tell you it wasn't on my bucket list. I went to school one day and came home an aspiring author.
Okay, so could you give us then an overview of the book and the objectives you were hoping to achieve with it?
Sure. You know, I don't care where you live on this planet. I don't care if you're a teacher in the U.S. or the U.K. or Sub-Saharan Africa or East Asia or the Middle East. I like to think that all teachers want the same thing for their students. They want them to do well on whatever standardized test their country is requiring. They want them to succeed later on at the college level. They want them to compare favorably with kids in other parts of the globe. But I think, Barry, I hope most teachers want their young people to find happiness in life. And what I see in contemporary education here in America, and it's probably true in your country as well, is we've become so focused on accountability,
yeah,
and so focused on the manufacturing process of learning. We've become so focused on content,
sure,
and
yeah,
pedagogy, yeah, and technology that we've lost sight of the child. We've lost sight of the fact that this is a people business. And when we do that, I think we get into trouble. So I wanted to write a book to help people remember that, you know, this is a people business and we need to form those relationships.
Yeah, so it's about teaching the whole person in a sense then.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, man, this is a beautiful job. Like I said, I've done it for 30 years and I'm looking at retirement soon. And I just can't imagine what's going to replace that wonderful interaction I have with these young people on a daily basis when I retire. So I might be pretty reluctant to do that.
Okay, so could you give us an idea of some of the strategies that teachers might employ to help them to relate to their students better then?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to go off on a little riff here.
Yeah, sure.
I wrote this book. It was published in March. And a local school leader read it and was enthusiastic, gave me a call and says, I want you to become familiar with a man called John Hattie. Now, John Hattie is a researcher from Australia who wrote a landmark book in 2008 called Visible Learning. And this book is very popular in the States. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of your audience that are in education may have heard of it.
Okay.
Now, what John Hattie did in his book is he made a list of 138 influences on student learning. Now, number one on this list is self-evaluation. Apparently, students do very well, like if they do an assignment for me, I give them the rubric, the grading rubric, and I say, go through your assignment, make corrections, and give it back to me. Kids learn a lot when they evaluate their own work.
And I suppose you're appealing to their autonomy as well in that way, aren't you?
Yes, sir. And number 138 places, the worst thing that can happen to a student is if they move from school to school to school to school.
Yeah.
So that is student mobility.
Right.
So you're an old teacher, Barry. You probably have seen this. You know, kid moves into your class on October 1st and she's gone on November 1st.
Yeah, stability is vital, I think. I agree.
Right. So I was really curious why the school leader was calling me up and suggesting that I read this book. Obviously, it had something to do with student-teacher relationships, and it did. Student-teacher relationships came in 11th place out of 138. And it's far ahead of a lot of things that we might think are more important. Professional development was in 19th place. Socioeconomic status of the child, which we think is, well, it is important, but we think it is so important, was in 32nd place.
Yeah.
Principals and school leaders was in 74th place. And class size was in 107th place. So student-teacher relationships are essential to the learning process. So that was an advertisement for why my topic is important.
Yeah.
Now let me tell you a little bit about, let me answer your question more directly. If you've been in teaching long enough, you've been subject to a lot of professional development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in my 30 years, I was just making a list before I came on the air today. I've been told how to differentiate. I've been told how to do rubrics. I've been told how to do summative, formative assessments. I've learned how to do think, pair, share, self-directed learning, professional learning communities, bring your own technology, creation of teacher websites, flipped classrooms, essential questions. And here in the U.S., it's all about project-based learning right now.
Yeah.
I can't remember once in my 30 years any administrator standing before me and say, okay, staff, today we're going to work on bonding with our students. So my whole purpose in writing the book was to give teachers and future teachers tools, activities that they could use to help bond with students.
Sure, okay. I'm just thinking the idea of relating to students might feel quite intimidating to some teachers who, you know, who may feel if they don't keep a certain distance, the things might go a bit awry. What's your response to that?
Well, one of the interesting things, it's a very typical pushback whenever I talk about, hey, bonding with students is so important. It's one of the most important things you can do.
Yep.
A lot of people look at me and they say, well, Jim, you're an extroverted guy. You know, you're one of those backslappers, you know, high fivers, handshakers, finger pointers, chest bumpers. I'm one of those guys in the hallway of my school that's pointing at kids and yelling hello down the hallway. I am one of those guys.
Yeah.
But here's something that's really interesting. I was on an NPR, that's National Public Radio. It's like the BBC in your country.
Yeah.
And I was on a show this past summer, and this whole issue of personality came up. And I was on this show with a lady by the name of Elizabeth Green, who's a prominent education researcher here in the United States.
Yeah.
And she really tackled this question on my behalf, which I was grateful for. She did this quote right here. I love this. So many researchers have searched for the personality that's the silver bullet when it comes to effective teaching, and they don't turn it up. In other words, you can be an introverted person and be very successful connecting with students. And in getting back to your question, I think sometimes when people hear this, they think that they have to be something that they're not naturally. You can be a pretty calm, reflective person and be very successful connecting with students. About 10 years ago, we had a young lady come to our school to teach science. And when I first saw her and when I first met her, I was worried that she might struggle a little bit corralling these high school kids. She's a very reserved person, very quiet person, very cerebral person. But what I witnessed over the 10 years that she was in the classroom is she started to do the right things with students. She had a firm grasp of her strengths as a person.
Okay.
She was very available for the students. She was a very encouraging person. She also was very serious about her curriculum. And she also had this knack for comforting a student when that student was in crisis. And so what I saw over the 10 years she was in the classroom is she started to play to her strengths. So in answering your question about the person who might be a little hesitant, a little reticent, they probably have strengths. If they're in the classroom at all, they have strengths. And they don't need to be somebody that they're not. They don't need to try to pretend like they're the guy down the hall that's always blaring away.
Yeah.
They can be the person that they are and be very successful. I think after the 10 years, I think this lady who's named Jeannie Collette, who went into our guidance office, I think she was the most popular person on our staff. And when I first met her, I thought, oh boy, I think she might struggle. And she might have had some of those fears like you just voiced.
Just another thought on this, though. Students themselves, though, might not want to be related to and could be could be suspicious or even hostile. How do you approach this?
Well, Barry, I think I face that probably about 7 or 8 times every day, if not every period. I mean, it is an integral part of the job. I teach in a public high school. I mean, we teach everybody, man. We don't have, you know, we don't have millionaires in this school. I mean, I have it all. And I'm going to tell you, I hope you don't mind, I'm big on telling stories, and I'm going to tell you why I'm big on telling stories before the program is over.
Stories are great. You go ahead.
All right. I want to tell you what happened to me in the dawn of my teaching career, which told me how to answer the question you just asked. I was confronted with a group of students who were nothing like me. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't see me, but I'm a white guy. Almost all of my students were African American. They were mostly poor. They had almost zero interest in the subject I was teaching. But I was really determined to have a relationship with these students.
Yeah.
What I failed to appreciate, what I failed to, understand, or what I failed to put stock in, was I was as alien to them as they were to me. I mean, here I was, this little guy that was all gung-ho about my subject matter. And in retrospect, I came on way too strong. Now, these kids wanted nothing to do with me. They're exactly the type of students that you just described. And not only did they want nothing to do with me, they would also undermine a lot of the things I was trying to do in class. And this was back when I was a really young teacher. And I can remember, you know, we start school around here in early September. Uh-huh. And that whole month of September, I was thinking, I'm not succeeding with these kids. I don't know what's going on here. You know, I'm being nice to them. I'm reaching them out. And they wanted nothing to do with me. So I was really frustrated. September worked its way into October, and I'll never forget this. It was the biggest learning experience of my career. Kids came filing in one time after a weekend, and I had them working in pairs on something, but they weren't interested in the assignment. They were interested in talking about their weekends, which was very frustrating. And there was a couple guys right up near my desk, a couple young guys, and they were really loud. And part of me was ready to say, come on, guys, you're not going to want to work on this later. Let's just get a start on this. But Barry, something in me said, you know, you ought to just shut up and listen to their conversation and you might learn something. So I pretend like I was working at something at the desk, but really I was listening to these kids talk about their home lives, which were just chaotic. I mean, a lot of the adults in their home lives were making ridiculous decisions on a regular basis. So the light went on. Here I am. I'm an adult. I'm trying to work my way into these kids' lives. It's a rational act on their part to be standoffish. I'd be standoffish if I were them. And from that point on, I made two very minor adjustments in the way I interacted with these students that paid huge dividends. Number one, when I started to interact with these kids in the future, and here's that word ego, I was going to try to pull my ego out of the situation and just watch the conversation unfold like a removed observer. And what I did when I started doing this is I became very interested in what was taking place and less invested in my self-esteem.
Sure, yeah.
And that was fun. It became like this interesting game where like someone says something and you're like, oh, wow, I wonder why they said that. Maybe that's the motivation for that. So that was number one. That was adjustment number one. The other adjustment I made was I just decided, hey, these kids have had a lot of adults disappoint them in their lives. It's a rational act for them to be standoffish. This is going to take longer than I anticipated. I need to be patient. So by becoming more patient and pulling my ego out of the situation, what I found is that I relaxed a lot. And what I've learned in teaching is often your students are a mirror image of you. When you relax some, they relax some. It was pretty interesting. A couple of days later, I was asking a question about civil rights. I mean, these were African-American students, so they're well-versed in civil rights. And I asked the question, who was the African-American baseball player, the first in the major leagues in 1947? These kids had heard this answer probably since they were 5 years old. It was Jackie Robinson. Some kid puts up his hand and says, that was Adolf Hitler. Now, that kid knew that was the wrong answer. Everybody in the room breaks up laughing. And before I had my eureka moment, that probably would have frustrated me. But something interesting happened. I became less invested in my ego in that situation, and I pictured Adolf Hitler in a baseball uniform, and I broke up laughing. And what's more, all the students in the class started laughing too. So the first time since school started, we were all laughing together. And I have to tell you, there's two minor adjustments. By Thanksgiving vacation, which is in November, I was pretty close to those kids.
Yeah.
And by spring break in March, I had them, man. So that really got me thinking that there are things that you can do. There are tactics that you can employ, which can dramatically impact how you relate to students.
And then presumably learning really improves too once you've got that in place.
According to John Hattie, that is absolutely one of the best things you can do for a kid's learning is for that child to have a strong relationship with his teacher. And according to my observations over my career, it's absolutely essential.
So those kids then are feeling a number of things. They're feeling safe, they're feeling supported, and they feel that they can presumably have a joke with you back and forth. And so that creates that fluidity for them to be creative in a sense.
Right. And I think there's an important word. It's approachable.
Right.
When you become approachable, that's when relationships can be forged.
Right. Yeah.
And I think before I had my eureka moment with those kids, I wasn't approachable. Now, what's interesting is I was intimidated by them. But I think that that can come out in ways through your nonverbal language, through your tone. You can be not a very approachable person. And so I think a big part of it is you need to become approachable. Now, Barry, there are some kids that are just not on board with the whole education thing.
Yeah.
And that's okay. They are where they are. But you forging a relationship with those students at least creates the potential that if the student has some type of paradigm shift, you're in a good position to help them grow.
That sounds great, yeah. Hey, you also mentioned that sharing personal stuff can be helpful in this regard too, yeah?
I love this question. Thank you so much for asking that. And we're going to get back to approachability right now. This is a cliche that a lot of American administrators tell their staff. They'll say, hey, you need to get to know your students. Well, as you pointed out, some kids are not easy to get to know. Some of them are pretty closed down. And if you try to force your way in or try to get to know them before they're ready, it's counterproductive. So in asking what can you encourage teachers to do, I'm going to give your audience a simple how-to on how to bond with students, and it has to do with becoming more approachable. Now, when I'm told get to know your students, I'm going to propose the best way to do that is to reverse engineer the problem.
Okay.
And you're going to become approachable, and here's the way I do it. I'll walk into class, and I will put an image on my smart board of what I made for dinner last night. And I'll take a couple minutes right before we start the lesson telling them about the meal I just made. I'll come in and put a picture of a new restaurant that I went to that I enjoyed. I'll take a picture of myself working out, talking about a new workout I did that I enjoyed. Yeah. I'll put up pictures of my pets, my dogs. I have a great picture in my book of my pug slash dachshund getting a toenail trim from our custodian's wife's dog grooming salon. Now, this doesn't take much time out of class. And what I found is when I do this on a regular basis, I become approachable, safe, interesting. I become somebody that the kids can bond with.
Sure.
Now, like I said, I've been doing this for a while, and this has happened to me so many times I can't count it. When I do this, you'll have a kid come up to you that has never spoken to you. Pull out their smartphone and say, let me show you a picture of my dog. Let me tell you what we had for dinner last night. Because all of a sudden, you've just made it safe for this kid to come up and do this.
Sure, yeah.
Here's one thing I've also had happen, is I've also had a kid put up their hand and say, this is stupid. This is a waste of instructional time. Why are you doing this? That kid doesn't speak for everybody. Also, I think you just identified the kid that you need to work on a relationship with. And something that's happened to me is that kid that voices that negative comment is oftentimes the first one up there showing you a picture of his dog a week later. So even though it might not be a positive interaction at first, you're making an impression on that kid.
You've just made me think of something from my own experience. I used to be a TEFL teacher, or what you'd say in the United States as a TESOL teacher, teaching English as a second language, and we used to use music quite a lot as a way of bonding, and you'd often use songs and get we'd do sort of various things with songs. But one way that you could really actually wind up a student was if you tried to get their music, because I don't know if you can remember when you were a teenager, James, the last thing you wanted in the world was for an adult to get the music you're into, because that was the whole point, that they didn't get it. You know?
That's beautiful, my friend. Yeah, and you know something, they do appreciate when you're willing to look silly, too.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Anyway, you also talk about the importance of not shying away from conflictive situations. That's vital, you say.
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody who read my book made this comment one time. They said, geez, it seems like you are so friendly and so nice. I couldn't imagine that you would ever confront a student. And one thing you have to understand is, you know, sometimes when you turn a book into an editor, some things get changed. And one of the things that got changed in my book is my editor felt like I was a little too direct at times, which, you know, I can totally understand why that's something that she didn't want in there. But look, if you're going to be in a school classroom, a public school classroom, I don't care what country you're in, and you're afraid of confronting students that are being dangerous or abusive to other students, then this isn't the job for you. You know, your role is to protect kids and make a safe environment. And there are times when you have to confront students, and I have no problem doing that. But what you have to do is you can't get personally invested in the whole, I don't know, drama that's going on.
Yeah.
You have to keep perspective, and you know, I've been called names and I've been threatened and all that stuff, And, you know, as a younger man, I probably didn't handle it as well.
Yeah.
Now with old guy, it doesn't even faze me.
Yeah, and
I feel empathy for the kid. As a matter of fact, when that happens, I make a note. I want to get a relationship with this student. And I always encourage our administrator to make sure that kid's in my class. And one thing, we have an expression here in the United States, it just is game on, which just means, you know, let the games begin. And sometimes when you get kids like that, if you take that attitude about it, hey, this is an interesting challenge, it really pays big dividends as well. And it's a good mindset.
Yeah. I suppose this brings up the issue of boundaries, because I think, you know, students, especially younger ones, they arguably need certain boundaries in order for not only for the well-being of the class as a whole, but for learning to take place. But then it's also important for them that they can play with these boundaries as well. So, well, I suppose we've been talking about this to an extent, but do you have any other thoughts on that?
Sure. I sound like I sound very repetitive at times.
No.
But one thing that I believe is the greatest classroom management tool in the world is a strong relationship with the students. There's just a healthy respect between you and the kids, which just eliminates so many problems in dealing with classroom management. Now, you're talking about boundaries. I'll give you a great example of how this can play out. You have the expression in the UK probably of the class clown, correct?
Yeah.
The student that's disruptive, that's maybe sarcastic, that undermines the things that you're going to do. You need to take on the class clown by building a relationship with the class clown.
Yeah.
You need to forge that bond with the class clown. And if you are able to achieve this, and this is just wonderful, you will find that their humor, which before was destructive, actually adds to the atmosphere of your class. I guarantee you, even if you're not a funny person or a humorous person, you have humorous students in your class.
Sure.
If you can create an atmosphere where those kids are allowed to express themselves in a humorous way, in a constructive way, you will make your class a magic environment. Now, bonding with class clowns is one of the most difficult things there is, because they don't let it happen very easy. And it doesn't happen very quickly.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous exercise in patience and self-control and you know, keeping your ego in line. But come on, man, you're the adult.
Oh, yeah.
Take it on as a game.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can have your firm boundaries, but don't take it personally if a kid violates one of those boundaries. Maintain your calm. And just say, you know, you did this, here's a consequence, but don't get too invested in the drama of the situation. And I've found that I've had very, very few discipline problems because of that attitude. And I've taught in some challenging circumstances.
Okay. How do you handle a student that wants your attention all the time, or a lot of the time?
Sure. You know, there are kids that try to monopolize your attention. There are students who are very outspoken. There are students who are very extroverted. There are students who are very talented.
Yeah.
There's some students that are very needy. And I've had all of those in class. And it's a great question you ask. It's something that I battle sometimes, because I never want to discourage a kid from expressing themselves. I never want to discourage a kid from expressing an opinion that I mean, that's wonderful when kids are willing to do that. But you're right. Sometimes they can monopolize things. And so my goal would be to maybe not call on them as often, maybe not start an interaction as much, and really encourage the classmates, the colleagues that child has in class, to become more animated, more participatory.
Okay.
Now, that's not easy to do. I'm not going to pretend like I have a magic answer to that one. That's tough. We're doing something on Friday in my class, which is called a Socratic circle. A Socratic circle is where a group of students have a problem they're trying to figure out together. Now, obviously, in that situation, there are some kids that are smarter than others. There are some kids that are more articulate than others. There's some kids that are better prepared than others. but I try to meet with the shyer students, meet with the less prepared students individually before the activity and really encourage them. Hey, ask a question, do something low risk. Throw your two cents in. Just give us something during the Socratic circle. And what I found is if you can get them out of their shell a little bit, it becomes somewhat of a snowball effect and they start to do it more and more and more. But that question you asked, Barry, is not easy.
Yeah.
That is something I've thought about, and I don't know that I have a great answer on that one. I'll tell you one thing. As a teacher, you need to be aware that that's going on and try to make adjustments. That's a part of the problem right there.
You highlighted something there. A big part of this process is actually being aware of what's going on in your classroom, isn't it? Do you also do things like peer observations? I remember I had an experience, again, with a peer observation. I asked a fellow teacher just to notice how many times I said okay in the classroom. And I said it about 100 times in an hour. In this regard, you can also, I got other teachers to see where my attention was directed in the class as well.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
And the nice thing about doing peer teacher observation, you don't feel the pressure that you're having to jump through hoops for your line manager. It's a lot more supported situation. I don't know if you do that as well.
You know, I do something that'll interest you. I have my students act like my evaluators on a regular basis.
Oh, that's great.
And what I'll say is something like, for instance, in writing my book, I learned a lot about nonverbal communication. So it's kind of like your, what would you say? You said the word okay a lot, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, I had my students talk about, evaluate my body language for a few weeks. And I gave them a list of things to look for, and then I wanted some feedback from them. And they really enjoyed critiquing me. And I learned quite a bit. And I'm going to tell you something that I wasn't doing very well that I think will intrigue you. I wasn't doing a great job with eye contact with lots of different kids.
Right. Interesting.
I found myself doing kind of like what you said. I had some outgoing kids, and I tended to look at them and call on them. And you know, with a class of 25 students, there were a lot of kids that I think were feeling left out.
Yeah.
And so I was not aware that I was doing this until my smart students pointed it out to me. And that really got the wheels turning. Okay, how can I alleviate this issue? And I just came up with a basic solution. There's nothing revolutionary about it, but I would try to make eye contact with a different face on a minute by minute basis and try to make eye contact with most kids in the room during the period. And I would often accompany the eye contact with a statement like, "And do you know what happened next, Marcus?" Or, just some type of thing to make Marcus feel included. But Barry, I had no clue that I was not doing a good job with eye contact until my smart students pointed it out. That was a wonderful question you asked me, sir.
But that's a great example of your, you know, you talked about at the beginning that you have a very good rapport in many of your classes. To actually have a situation where you can, you're confident and they're confident enough to actually be constructively critical about your teaching approach says a lot for the atmosphere that I can imagine in that classroom.
Thank you so much, Barry. I'll tell you one way I also sold it was I said, I'm going to help you in your romantic relationships with this nonverbal communication. And I told them some things that they could check for people that they found attractive to see if the feelings were mutual. The interest level went through the roof.
Okay, just moving on here. One of the points you also make in the book is that the generation gap has always been there, and for teachers not to get caught up in nostalgic thinking. I think you mentioned in the book that you've come across that a fair bit with teachers. Am I correct?
Sure. And I want to give you a quote here. I think you're going to love this quote. "I see no hope for the future of our people if they are dependent on the frivolous youth of today. For certainly all youth are reckless beyond words. When I was a boy, we were taught to be discreet and respectful of elders. But the present youth are exceedingly wise and impatient of restraint. Now that seems like a contemporary complaint about young people. That's from 700 BCE, Hesiod, the poet of ancient Greece, and that's 200 years prior to Athens' golden age.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a society that was on the way up. That was a society that was going places, and people felt about their youth that way in that evolving society.
Yeah, I think that there's also graffiti in Pompeii about that our parents don't understand us, and it's the other way
around. So, you know, once you just embrace that statement that you and I just made, you're almost there.
Yeah.
You're almost there already. And, you know, here's something that's kind of interesting. I went to my first school, kindergarten here in America. You go to kindergarten at age 5. And my first day of kindergarten was September of 1966. And I look back at America in 1966, and man, I had it all. I mean, I was white, male, Christian, both biological parents. My parents were fairly affluent. I mean, I had it all. Now, it's easy for someone like me to look back at those times and say, well, those were the good old days.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of people that couldn't check off those boxes. I mean, if you think about, like, being non-white, non-Christian, or female, you just were not taken seriously in the United States in 1966 if you were those things. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that you have to do is you have to, number one, look back at the good old days and say, you know, well, it wasn't the good old days for a lot of people. It might have been for me, but it wasn't. But here's the one thing I'm going to lay on you, and this gets right into this, you know, I teach a class, one of the topics is Buddhism, and it's really helped me with this, mindfulness, living in the present. Those times aren't coming back. Now, you might long for the mother country back, you know, in 1980 when you were young and just full of everything, but your kids don't care about that.
Sure.
You know, they barely care what happened last week. And they're citizens of the present, and as soon as you embrace that paradigm, you're going to be so much better off. You know, it's funny, I've been teaching in my school right now for a number of years, and many of the teachers in the building were once my students. And I was walking out of the building one day, and our students, all our kids drive here in America, it's ridiculous, but they were out in the parking lot, and they were revving their cars and acting like maniacs, and this young woman looked at me, who was about 28 years old, and said, I can't believe the way kids are acting in the parking lot these days. And it's like, I had you in class 10 years ago, and your friends acting the same way. So nostalgia happens really quickly. It's really damaging. It just forms a barrier between you and your students.
Yeah. They say the best of times is always 30 years ago. Whatever.
You got that right. Yeah. You got that right.
Yeah. Okay. What is your understanding of the middle way, James, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yes, I teach in a very conservative place. I'm not a conservative person, though. I teach a class, it's a world history class, and we study China, India, Islam, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Mesoamerica. What's missing is Europe and North America, which is really interesting because the vast majority of my students are white kids. The vast majority of my students are Christian kids, conservative kids. Now, I started teaching this class about 20 years ago, and I think most teachers who enjoy their subject matter have probably experienced this in life. You're teaching something that's very meaningful, and you are as much a student as the students in your class. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I love is I love the Asian paradigm to life. Life is not a one-shot proposition. Live in the moment. Don't live in the extremes. Mm-hmm. I have amazing reverence for Siddhartha Gautama. And I first heard this concept of the middle way in teaching about him. This concept that he was an ascetic and he found that unfulfilling. this concept that he indulged in all the sensory pleasures, and that was unfulfilling as well. And so when he stopped trying so hard, stopped striving so hard, sat underneath the tree and just meditated, the answers came to him. That was a huge, it had a huge impact on me. It made me think about the way I live my life, the way it made me think about the way I teach. Mm-hmm. And my concept of the middle way in terms of the way I interact with students is to do the same thing, not to force things. Be authentic. Allow kids to express themselves. Have boundaries, but don't get personally invested in someone else's actions. And I have found that has served me very well.
Well, that's great. But if people, this is my last question, James. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, I told you before we went on air that my name is supposedly a British name. And it's the spelling of it's problematic for a lot of people. So I do have a website, I do have an email, and I'm going to give you those right now. My website is James Alan Sturtevant. And Alan is spelled kind of interesting. It's A-L-A-N. Sturtevant, my last name, is spelled S-T-U-R. T as in Thomas, E, V as in Victor, A-N-T. So it's jamesallensturtevant.com. And then my email address is P, my wife's name is Penny, so P, J, James, Sturtevant, @gmail.com. And if you have an interest in my book, it's called You've Gotta Connect. It's available on Amazon, it's available on Kindle.
Okay, well, that's great, James. Anyway, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much for giving up your time to talk to me.
Barry, this means so much. I've been on a couple podcasts, and every time I've been on one of these, I interact with the host later because I just enjoy talking to people so much. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.